24. The barman of the motel at Glen Armand said that Hanlon had come in around 9 the night before and bragged of renting his caravan to an English literary gent. On the strength of this transaction, he put back 5 double scotches, fell, and banged his head on the floor. Expecting him to be sober by morning, they carried him to a room out back. There, in the early hours, a truckie heard him groaning, and they found him on the floor again, clutching his abdomen, with his shirt torn to ribbons. They called his mate, Frank Olson, who drove him down to Alice. He was on the operating table by 11.
"Some talk of a blockage," said the barman sententiously. "Usually means one thing."
There was a payphone on the bar. Arcady put through a call to the hospital. The nurse on duty said Hanlon was comfortable and asleep. "So what's the matter?" I asked.
"She wouldn't say."
The bar itself was made up of disused wooden railway sleepers, and above it hung a notice. All liquor must be consumed on the premises. I looked at a picture on the wall. It was an artist's impression, in watercolour, of the proposed Glen Armand Memorial Dingo Complex. The word memorial referred to the dingo which either ate or did not eat the infant Azaria Chamberlain. The plans called for a fiberglass dingo about 60 feet high, with a spiral staircase up its forelegs and a dark red restaurant inside its belly. "Incredible," I said.
"No," said Arcady. "Humorous."
The night bus to Darwin drew up outside, and the bar filled up with passengers. There were Germans, Japanese, a pink-kneed Englishman, and the usual cast of Territorians. They ate pie and ice cream, drank, went outside to piss, and came back to drink again. The stopover lasted 15 minutes. Then the driver called, and they all trooped out, leaving the bar to its core of regulars. At the far end of the room, a fat Lebanese was playing pool with a gaunt, fair-haired young man who had one wall eye and was trying to explain in a stutter how aboriginal kinship systems were
so-so-c-com-fuck-fucking-plex.
At the bar, a big man with a purple birthmark on his neck was methodically swilling scotches through his rotted teeth and talking to the police patrolman whom we had met the day before at Burnt Flat. He had changed into jeans, a gold neck chain, and a clean white singlet. Out of uniform, he appeared to have shrunk. His arms were thin and white, above the line of his shirt cuffs. His Alsatian lay very still, leashed to the barstool, eyeing some aboriginals, its ears pricked up and tongue extended. The policeman turned to me.
"So what'll it be?"
I hesitated.
"What are you drinking?"
"Scotch and soda," I said. "Thank you."
"Ice?"
"Ice."
"So you're a rider, eh?"
"News gets around."
"What kind of writing?"
"Books," I said.
"Published?"
"Yes."
"Science fiction?"
"No."
"Ever write a bestseller?"
"Never."
"I'm thinking of writing a bestseller myself."
"Good on you."
"You wouldn't believe some of the stories I hear."
"I certainly would."
"Unbelievable stories," he said in his thin, petulant voice. "It's all there."
"Where?"
"In my head."
"The great thing's to get it onto paper."
"I got a great title."
"Good."
"You want me to tell you?"
"If you like." He dropped his jaw and gaped at me.
"You must be joking, mate. You think I'd give away my title? You might use it. That title's worth money."
"Then you should hang on to it."
"A title," he said with great feeling, "can make or break a book.
Think of Ed McBain, Killers Payoff. Think of Shark City or Eden's Burning. Think of The Day of the Dog. Great titles." The cash value of his title he estimated at $50,000. With a title like that, you could make a great movie, even without the book.
"Even without the story," I suggested.
"Could do,"
he nodded. "Titles changed hands for millions," he said, "in the United States." Not that he was going to sell off his title to a movie company. The title and the story belonged together.
"Nah," he shook his head thoughtfully, "I wouldn't want to part them."
"You shouldn't."
"Maybe we could collaborate," he said.
He visualized an artistic and business partnership. He would provide the title and the story. I would write the book, because he, as a policeman, did not have the leisure for writing.
Writing takes time, I agreed.
Would you be interested?
No. He looked disappointed. He was not prepared yet to tell me the title, but to whet my appetite, he proposed to let me in on the plot. The plot of his unbelievable story began with an Aboriginal being flattened by a road train. And?
I better tell you, he said.
He moistened his lips. He had come to a big decision.
Body bag, he said.
Body bag? He closed his eyes and smiled.
I never told anyone before, he said.
But body bag?
The bag you put the body in. I tell you, the story starts with a dead coon on the highway.
You did.
You like it?
He asked, anxiously. No.
I mean the title.
I know you mean the title. I turned to the man with the purple birthmark who was sitting on my left. He had been stationed in England during the war near Leicester. He had fought in France and then married a girl from Leicester. The wife came to live in Australia, but went back with their child to Leicester. He had heard we were surveying sacred sites.
Now the best thing to do with a sacred site, he drawled.
What?
Dynamite.
He grinned and raised his glass to the Aboriginals. The birthmark oscillated as he drank. One of the Aboriginals, a very thin hillbilly type, with a frenzy of matted hair, leaned both elbows on the counter and listened.
Sacred sites, the big man leered. If all what them says was sacred sites, there'd be 300 bloody billion sacred sites in Australia.
Not far wrong, mate, called the thin Aboriginal.
Over on my right, I could hear Arcady talking to the policeman. They had both lived in Adelaide, in the suburb of St. Peter's. They had gone to the same school. They'd had the same maths master, but the policeman was 5 years older.
It's a small world, he said.
It is, said Arcady.
So why do you bother with him?
The policeman jerked his thumb at the Aboriginals.
Because I like them. And I like them, he said. I like them. I like to do what's right by them, but they're different.
In what way different?
The policeman moistened his lips again and sucked the air between his teeth.
Made differently, he said at last. They've got different urinary tracts to the white man. Different waterworks. That's why they can't hold their booze.
How do you know?
It's been proved, said the policeman. Scientifically.
Who by?
I don't recall.
The fact was, he went on, there should be two different drinking laws, one for whites and one for blacks.
You think so?
Said Arcady.
Penalise a man for having better waterworks,
said the policeman, his voice lifting in indignation.
It's unfair. It's unconstitutional.
The Alsatian whined, and he patted it on the head. From having different waterworks was an easy step to having different grey matter. An Aboriginal brain, he said, was different to that of Caucasians. The frontal lobes were flatter. Arcady narrowed his eyes to a pair of tartar slits. He was now quite nettled.
I like them, the policeman repeated. I never said I didn't like them, but they're like children. They've got a childish mentality.
What makes you think so?
They're incapable of progress, he said, and that's what's wrong with you land rights people. You're standing in the way of progress. You're helping them destroy white Australia.
Let me buy you a drink, I interrupted.
Nah, thanks,
the policeman snapped. His face was working wrathfully. His fingernails, I noticed, were bitten to the quick. Arcady waited a moment or two until he'd got control of his temper, and then began to explain, slowly and reasonably, how the surest way of judging a man's intelligence was his ability to handle words. Many Aboriginals, he said, by our standards, would rank as linguistic geniuses. The difference was one of outlook. The whites were forever changing the world to fit their doubtful vision of the future. The Aboriginals put all their mental energies into keeping the world the way it was. In what way was that inferior? The policeman's mouth shot downwards.
You're not Australian, he said to Arcady.
Oh, bloody am Australian.
Nah, you're not. I can tell you're not Australian.
I was born in Australia.
That doesn't make you Australian, he taunted. My people have lived in Australia for 5 generations, so where was your father born?
Arcady paused, and with quiet dignity answered,
My father was born in Russia.
Hey!
The policeman tightened his forelip and turned to the big man.
What did I tell you, Bert? A pom and a com.